Scientists have long known that a neurological Mason-Dixon line cleaves our brains into two regions, the left and the right hemispheres. But in the last 10 years, thanks in part to advances in functional magnetic resonance imaging, researchers have begun to identify more precisely how the two sides divide responsibilities. The left hemisphere handles sequence, literalness, and analysis. The right hemisphere, meanwhile, takes care of context, emotional expression, and synthesis. Of course, the human brain, with its 100 billion cells forging 1 quadrillion connections, is breathtakingly complex. The two hemispheres work in concert, and we enlist both sides for nearly everything we do. But the structure of our brains can help explain the contours of our times. Until recently, the abilities that led to success in school, work, and business were characteristic of the left hemisphere. They were the sorts of linear, logical, analytical talents measured by SATs and deployed by CPAs. Today, those capabilities are still necessary, but they're no longer sufficient. In a world upended by outsourcing, deluged with data, and choked with choices, the abilities that matter most are now closer in spirit to the specialties of the right hemisphere: artistry, empathy, seeing the big picture, and pursuing the transcendent. If you want to be sure that you are what I call an untouchable, argues Pink, a person with a job that a computer or robot cannot do faster or some talented foreigner cannot do cheaper, and just as well, you need to focus on constantly developing your right brain skills, such as forging relationships rather than executing transactions, tackling novel challenges instead of solving routine problems, and synthesizing the big picture rather than analyzing a single component. We're not all going to lose our jobs tomorrow, but as the cost of communicating with the other side of the globe falls essentially to zero, as India becomes, by 2010, the country with the most English speakers in the world, and as developing nations continue to mint millions of extremely capable knowledge workers, the professional lives of people in the West will change dramatically. If number crunching, chart reading, and code writing can be done for a lot less overseas and delivered to clients instantly via fiber optic cable, that's where the work will go. But those gusts of comparative advantage are blowing away only certain kinds of white-collar jobs, those that can be reduced to a set of rules, routines, and instructions. That's why narrow left-brain work, such as basic computer coding, accounting, legal research, and financial analysis, is migrating across the oceans. But that's also why plenty of opportunities remain for people and companies doing less routine work: programmers who can design entire systems, accountants who serve as life planners, and bankers expert less in the intricacies of Excel than in the art of the deal. Now that foreigners can do left-brain work cheaper, Pink argues, we in the U.S. must do right-brain work better. That, for me, is the key point. Now that foreigners can do left-brain work cheaper, we in the U.S. must do right-brain work better. In the last century, machines proved they could replace human muscle, added Pink. This century, technologies are proving they can outperform human left brains. They can execute sequential, reductive, computational work better, faster, and more accurately than even those with the highest IQs. Just ask chess grandmaster Garry Kasparov, who lost a match to a chess-playing computer. To flourish in this age, we'll need to supplement our well-developed high-tech abilities with aptitudes that are high-concept and high-touch. High-concept involves the ability to create artistic and emotional beauty, to detect patterns and opportunities, to craft a satisfying narrative, and to come up with inventions the world didn't know it was missing. High touch involves the capacity to empathize, to understand the subtleties of human interaction, to find joy in oneself and to elicit it in others, and to stretch beyond the quotidian in pursuit of purpose and meaning. Developing these high-concept, high-touch abilities won't be easy for everyone. For some, the prospect seems unattainable. Fear not, or at least fear less. The sorts of abilities that now matter most are fundamentally human attributes. After all, back on the savannah, our cave person ancestors weren't plugging numbers into spreadsheets or debugging code, but they were telling stories, demonstrating empathy, and designing innovations. These abilities have always been part of what it means to be human. It's just that after a few generations in the information age, many of our high-concept, high-touch muscles have atrophied. The challenge is to work them back into shape. But exactly how do you go about nurturing your right brain skills? The way you nurture your right brain is by doing something you love to do, or at least like to do, because if you do, you will bring something intangible to it, something out of your right brain, which cannot be easily repeated, automated, or outsourced. As Pink put it, the sorts of abilities that matter most now, it turns out, are also the sorts of things that people do out of intrinsic motivation. Relatively few people become accountants out of a sense of intrinsic motivation. But intrinsic motivation is what propels people to become creators and empathizers, to become designers and storytellers and counselors and consultants. This weekend, there will be accountants painting watercolors in their garages. There will be lawyers writing screenplays. But I guarantee you that you won't find any sculptors who on weekends will be doing other people's taxes for fun. In other words, there is a growing congruence between the sorts of things that people do because they love doing them and the sorts of things that confer economic advantage. And so, concludes Pink, when you hear your parents or your college graduation speaker telling you to do what you love, they are not giving you some syrupy pablum. They are giving you a survival strategy. Tubas and test tubes. So let's work backwards now just one more step. If the jobs of the new middle require you to be a good collaborator, leverager, adapter, synthesizer, model builder, localizer, or personalizer, and these approaches require you, among other things, to be able to learn how to learn, to bring curiosity and passion to your work, to play well with others, and to nurture your right brain skills, what does that mean specifically for education? Again, I am not an educator, so I come to this question with great humility. I am a reporter, though, and I can report that there are some real educators out there who have tried to address precisely this question head-on. I am actually quite excited by the amount of experimentation I have seen on college campuses as they try to design the right education for the new middle. I am going to focus on one school, Georgia Institute of Technology, based in Atlanta, to illustrate one thoughtful approach. G. Wayne Clough, Georgia Tech's president, had to rethink education in a flattening world out of sheer necessity. Clough took over as president in 1994. When I came to Tech as an awestruck freshman back in the 60s, Clough told me, they had this drill for the incoming students. They would tell us, look to your left, look to your right. Only one of you will graduate.